I'm Christopher Lydon with The Painter Who Tweets, Daisy Rockwell in her home and studio in Lebanon, New Hampshire. The imagery of the Age of Terror, the iconography, the faces of what is supposed to scare us has become her specialty online and in her provocative collection called The Little Book of Terror. This is open source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. We're here, Daisy, to shake up our responses, I'd say, to the visuals in this war story. And I'm hoping you're going to make us look again at the human beings with the guns in the lineup shots. The image of Saddam Hussein, for example, in the hands of his American dentists, based on real stories. Or a picture, for example, of an assumed militant pictured as a boy on his bed with his favorite cat. Or, for example, a pink and gold image of Osama bin Laden in what could have been his death mask. Plunge right in these images, what's going on?
First and foremost, I try to be as realistic as possible, which I think people will find odd because I think the colors are very vivid. With Osama bin Laden's death mask, there's sort of funny looking wormy things coming out of his face. But what I'm thinking about is, what am I actually looking at? That's my main goal, is to look very hard at some image that's brought out by the news media and try to figure out what it's really saying to me. So when I paint it, it's kind of like an act of research. I examine it very, very hard, and I paint it as truthfully as I can. And what comes out is the results of my research. So sometimes there's something fanciful, like with Osama bin Laden's death mask, and that's because nobody gave us a picture of what he looked like when he was dead. There was actually a decision not to show the public a picture of Osama bin Laden after he'd been killed, and that leads our imaginations to wander, and we wonder what actually happened. Did they actually get him? Who was it that they killed? Why aren't they showing us the picture? So that's a subject also of an essay in my book.
Take the image of Saddam Hussein in a kind of clown pajama suit, hair again all over the place. He's being probed unmercifully with these tongue sticks by an American dentistry team. What was going on in the picture? What was going on in your conversion of the image?
Well, my conversion of the image, I wasn't actually wearing a clownish nightgown. I just put that in there. But the rest of it is truthful. And I think, as I wrote in my essay that goes with the painting, I think Americans associate dentistry with torture more than they associate things like Abu Ghraib with torture. And it's a sort of a masterful piece of propaganda to show us. It says to us, oh, they're torturing him. Excellent. Because, you know, since he is the big bad enemy, we have to make sure that he's being treated as ruthlessly as possible. So the Americans can say, you know, he's being treated humanely. Look, we're giving him dental care. How good can that be? I mean, that Americans give the best dental care in the world, but still there's a coded message to American citizens, which is we're torturing him. You know, I think they gave him a root canal or something like that.
With anesthesia or not? he would have administered without anesthesia.
I think they assume that there would be not enough anesthesia, perhaps. Just a little bit too little anesthesia.
Decode the image on the cover of The Little Book of Terror. A woman and her boyfriend, it looks like, both with guns, both very casually enjoying a kind of cold moment in each other's arms, it seems.
That was a portrait of the Dagestani woman who allegedly was one of two suicide bombers who blew up the Moscow subway. And the picture is of her and her husband, who had been killed earlier by Russian forces. And so supposedly this suicide attack was in retaliation. The original image was on the cover of the New York Times, and it was one of these blurry pictures that people upload to their Facebook page. And, you know, that obviously they were sitting in front of their computer posing like that. But it was clearly one of those intimate images that are generated by people's laptops. And so it was very grainy. And it was right on the cover of the New York Times. And I remember seeing it in a rest stop in Vermont on that day that it came out. And you just sort of leap back at everything that that image tells us. And again, I think that any image that gets published in the newspaper is a piece of propaganda generally, because that's what the authorities have given the newspapers to print. So in this case, I think it's meant to show us how there's a common phrase is the culture of violence. She and all so-called jihadis are considered religious extremists, and they come from what's called a culture of violence. And I think all of these terminologies are used to make them seem less like us and more inhuman. Whereas on the other hand, the photograph told us other things, that they were like us in the sense that they sit in front of their computers taking silly pictures of themselves. And I was really struck by the intimacy between the two in the picture there. You know, there was a really strong emotional bond between them, and there was something a little bit like, as they would say, gangster about the couple. There was swagger to it. You weren't sure that they actually thought they were going to get away with the things that they ended up getting away with. They felt that swagger.
The fact that her head is covered tells you something, too. But as you say, they're in it together, Bonnie and Clyde or something.
Right.
They're lovers, but they're out there with the same purpose.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of it's a love story to me. Just the whole picture is a love story. And that image was actually featured on the cover of Penn Journals, one of their issue on lovers, which was a kind of an inspired choice. I think it's a love story, and you're right, a Bonnie and Clyde story. And you never know with people that couples have their own secret universes that nobody else can quite penetrate. So I think we're supposed to look at it and think, oh my goodness, there's armies of militants mobilizing all around the world against us or against truth and freedom. But to me, that's not what that picture was. That picture was about a couple and their secret world together, which ended up exploding onto a lot of other people.
Your images of people are very, should we say, Facebookable. They would look at home on the Facebook pages we scan every day.
No, it's true. I think that photography has become very intimate, and that teases out an important issue with the propaganda that we see in the newspapers, where I think a lot of the pictures we see initially of alleged terrorists are stern and sort of scary looking, and that make you, the minute you look at them, you think, oh, that person is cold, they have no heart. And then I started to think about it, and I realized that a lot of the times these are passport pictures where you're actually not allowed to smile. I had my passport picture taken about a month ago, and the woman said, don't smile, make sure not to smile, don't show your teeth. And then I thought, well, this is why, you know, that these guys look like this. They're not smiling or looking human because you're not supposed to in your passport picture or your visa picture. So you see, for example, the 911 hijackers, all arrayed in little rows in the New York Times, they all had the same expression on their face. And there was a reason for that, because it was all taken from their passports. And then to contrast that, there's these other images which have to do with the intimacy of photography with social networking and with camera phones, where people take pictures of their most intimate or most banal moments too. I mean, there's a real banality to photography, with people just taking thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures of themselves doing boring things and recording those on Facebook and so on. So you have this contrast set up, and that's one thing that I think fascinates me when I look for images besides the mugshot passport picture of an alleged terrorist. I try to find the banality, and you can always find something out there of these guys and the women as well.
I'm wondering, when do these mugshots, these passport pictures, start talking to you? And what are you listening for? And then when does the human being kind of break through?
I think some stories interest me more than others, and I'm not what you would call a completist. The term is used usually with collecting. So you say somebody that likes the Beatles so much that they collect all of Paul McCartney's Wings albums, even though they don't think they're very good. But if you're a completist, you have to have everything in the set. Yeah. So I'm not a completist. And so people are always saying, well, why haven't you done Muhammad Atta? Why didn't you do this person or that person? And the answer is because I'm not interested in Muhammad Atta. I mean, that I'm an artist. I'm not like a journalist or something like that. So I choose what fascinates me. And some of these narratives just interest me more, like the one that ended up in my painting Tuna Princess, which shows Alessa, Muhammad Alessa, lying on his bed with his cat, who was named Tuna Princess. So I think I read that story about how he and his friend were going to go and wage, quote unquote, violent jihad in Somalia. And you often these stories are slightly overwritten, so that starts to make me skeptical. Like, why did they say violent jihad? Like, why didn't they just say they wanted to join a militant group or something? It's kind of a little bit purple, the prose is always in these stories. So I read about how they planned to do this and then got caught at the airport, and then it comes out that there's an FBI informant, which usually is a signal that they probably were not smart enough to actually think of this idea themselves. I mean, that this comes up again and again and again in these stories, that this older kind of mentor-like figure appears, who is an FBI informant and is being paid quite a bit of money and also staying out of prison for some other charge, like tax evasion or something. And the FBI informant is full of these wild ideas for things that they should do, like build bombs and assassinate people, blow up the subway and all these things. So then they, after a lot of work, the informant gets these people that are usually kind of sad sack types that aren't really that effective. He gets them to hatch a plot and so on, and then they get arrested. Then the news starts to come out that they're sort of not really that effectual. So with this guy, Alessa, it started to come out. His mother actually gave some very interesting interviews and said that she was the source of that photograph. She said that he really wanted to take his cat Tuna Princess with him to wage violent jihad in Somalia, but that she would not allow him. And so he stole a big bag of candy from their convenience store instead and went off to the airport on his mission and then was arrested. And then it's later added the FBI confiscated the big bag of candy. So I think that kind of story just grabs me. There's other ones where people really are smart and capable of carrying out something scary, like Jihad Jane, who's in the book as well. She was this woman in Pennsylvania, a white American woman who lived with her boyfriend and his terminally ill father, and she cared for the father. And she had this secret online life where she converted to Islam and came engaged to a militant in Pakistan, I think. And she was plotting to kill the artist who created the Danish cartoon that caused so much uproar. And she's actually, after painting her portrait, at first I thought it was sort of a funny story, and after painting her portrait, started to feel like she's actually quite capable of doing something terrible. And she and some evidence of that is that she's called a self-radicalized. And this term, if you examine it closely, usually seems to have something to do with the alleged terrorists who didn't have an FBI informant helping them along, so they weirdly came up with these ideas all by themselves. She really shows an edge in her eyes when you look at her portrait. After I'd painted her portrait, I decided she was really quite scary.
Would you speak a little, Daisy Rockwell, about another American in the book, John Walker Lind, the American Taliban, as he became known? He's always been a special interest to me because right after he was arrested, a Jamaican in Kingston said to me, "Why does America want to hang him at ground zero? He's exactly the kind of American the world admires and loves. An adventurer, you know, head out for the territory, go native, learn somebody else's language, live another life. The great adventurer," as he said. Why was it that George Herbert Walker Bush, the ex-president, said, "This is the guy we've got to nail"? I can see that Bush father's finger sort of wagging. Why was that man such a provocation? And what is it you're trying to do in this rather shadowy but beautiful green and red and golden image of the man?
I feel a particular soft spot for John Walker Lind because I see in him something I strongly identify with, which is the desire to go to another place and really immerse yourself and learn a new language, as you say. But I didn't see that as an adventuresome thing. I saw that as a, you know, an exchange student kind of urge. And he just happened to somehow, you know, he lived in a family that was liberal enough that they let him just take off to Yemen, of all places, to learn Arabic. You know, they didn't say, well, honey, why don't you go to the American University in Cairo and we'll set up an exchange program for you or something like that. They just said, oh, sure. I mean, you know, who knows what he was like. But I think he was even a minor when he left. I have no idea. Maybe he spirited himself off and nobody could control it. But anyway, as somebody myself who has spent a lot of time learning a language that's very unlike my own, I really identified with that impulse. And I sort of think of him as the exchange student gone wrong, you know, that he immersed himself so much that he joined, well, basically, he was trying to join the Taliban, but apparently, well, he didn't really know Pashto or anything like that, so his Arabic was quite good by this point. So they made him go join the Al-Qaeda group because he wouldn't have been able to communicate with the Taliban. To me, I just think, wow, his Arabic was so good that they thought he could just go and seamlessly fit in with the Al-Qaeda people, and supposedly his Arabic is really good. So in that way, I sort of identify with him. Obviously, I don't identify with the desire to become a militant and live in caves. I think the reason why he was picked on was because of this narrative of us and them that was being really pushed at that time during the war. This sort of with us or against us, and people who hate our freedoms are religious fanatics and all this kind of thing. So there was this very conscious propaganda effort to divide the enemy out, to pinpoint what the enemy was, the otherness of the enemy, and the enemy is a religious fanatic, and the enemy doesn't just want to kill us, but wants to take our freedom away, which is one of the most vacuous rallying cries I've ever heard. And then here comes John Walker Lynn, an American kid who has converted to the enemy's religion. You know, we're never supposed to say that the war is against Muslims, but obviously that the way it's played out has been in a lot of people's minds. That's exactly what it is. So to see somebody who's converted and then gone and started living with them in that place was just sort of horrifying. And later, of course, it's now seen to be a really disastrous case because he was treated much more harshly than anyone else, except for obviously the people in Guantanamo. But it's not even that clear that he thought he was fighting against Americans. He was just bunked up in this sort of ongoing Afghanistan war. I mean, there's always on there, and he was a part of it at the time.
Daisy Rockwell, describe what it is that you do when you come upon these images. And let me provoke you maybe by saying you remind me somewhat of Shepard Fairey and his famous icon drawn from an AP news photograph that became the hope poster of Barack Obama. You come in with bold colors and clear lines and make something new out of these faces. What is it you're doing?
I think the Shepard Fairey comparison is fair, except for I also think of Shepard Fairey as kind of a pilferer. It's true, I don't always acknowledge the photographers of the images I use, but that's partly the fault of the internet, which is very hard to find out the sources sometimes of what you're using, especially these things that are dragged off of social media. But, you know, I think that the haziness, of course, in art, and not just copyright law, but in art, is, are you making something new? And to me, I'm just a portrait painter. But the people I paint portraits of, I can't get them to sit for me. You know, I can't go and get Osama bin Laden to sit for me. I mean, he's dead now, obviously, but I couldn't before either. It's logistically impossible. So I have to go and find something usable. I have to find the sources somehow. So I find them on the internet and I make them my own in a certain way by painting them. But I get very irritated because sometimes people ask me things like, you know, they think that they're collages, that I actually took the image and collaged it onto the canvas, or that I traced the image. They don't understand that I'm pretty traditional, that I sit and I look at the image and then I paint what I see. So it's the same as if they were sitting for me, only that it's from a photograph. I think it's actually easier to do it the other way if you had the people to sit for you, because then you can arrange the lighting properly. If only I could have had Osama bin Laden sit for me, then I would have had him sit in different lighting, for example, because he's usually been photographed in these kind of darker atmospheres. He might have been nicer to paint in direct sunlight, but I didn't have that opportunity.
But you're making me wonder, you know, when any portraitist looks at a bank president or a college dean or whoever is, you know, the subject, he or she is trying to make that face speak for all time in a fashion and reveal something, talk to us on some card or wall. What are you asking Osama bin Laden to reveal? Or the boy on his bed with the big eyes and his cat, Tuna Princess. What are you asking these people to tell us?
I mean, as somebody that's also a writer, there's plenty I can say with words. I feel like when I choose to paint something, it's because there's something to say that isn't verbal. That's why I said it's like an act of research. I don't have an agenda, at least that's known to me, other than revealing as much of the truth as I see it. I think of it as a subjective truth. It's the truth that I've found, but I want to find the truth about these people that are sort of over-discussed and over-reported on. And that's how I sort of started on this path. I became fascinated with bin Laden because I felt like everything about him was over-determined and there was no space in there for me to understand who he was and what kind of person would do the things that he had done or that he said he had done. It was very simple research. It was like the same as going into an archive and flipping through, you know, newspaper clippings and things like that. I simply look as hard as I can at somebody. And then there's this process of knowledge that takes place. I get to know them. I feel like they tell me something. It sounds a little bit sort of mystical, but I don't feel like it's mystical. I get to know who they are and I learn things. I have research findings and those findings are the painting. So what you see is what I got out of it. And again, this is a nonverbal piece of communication. and sometimes I add words to it. So the book has essays that I've written, you know, sometimes in tandem with the paintings I've done. But I wouldn't say that one could take the place of the other, that you could just say everything I said using words, that the paintings are saying something else, some truth that I learned.
Read, if you would, out of the book, Daisy Rockwell, what you wrote about Osama.
Right, here is what I wrote in the book. This is an essay that I wrote called Bloodlust, and there's a section on bin Laden, and then there's a section on Saddam Hussein and one on Elias Kashmiri, who's a militant in Pakistan. But I'll read the section on bin Laden. This is something I wrote shortly after he was killed. After watching Gone with the Wind at an impressionable age, I became obsessed with the flexibility of Clark Gable's eyebrows. I endeavored for many months afterwards to develop the muscles necessary to produce similar effects with my own eyebrows. I now bear the mark of my success on my 42-year-old face, a surprising fountain of wrinkles originating from my left eyebrow and shooting upward toward my hairline that seemed to have materialized overnight. At night, brushing my teeth before the mirror, I stare intently at the wrinkles and try to produce the facial expressions that created them. And then, I naturally think about age, and about death, and about Osama bin Laden's face, and what exactly the Navy SEALs did to it that makes photographs of his face unfit for public consumption. Whenever an impossibly famous individual disappears without a public viewing of the body, and sometimes even then, for example Elvis, rumors abound as to whether the personage in question is actually dead. The curious decision to keep from the public the image that would prove the kill has naturally fueled an abundance of theories, so that members of the U.S. government might not also feel inclined to indulge in such conspiracy theorizing, the White House set up a limited-access peep show to which selected individuals of prominent stature, such as John McCain, were invited to see the booty captured and killed by our boys. They came away convinced, slightly shaken, perhaps a little horrified, but gratified that with their tremendous stature came access to the nation's top drawer, death porn. Were his brains blown out, his eyes shot from his head, and if his face was revoltingly disfigured, how then would such a photograph make indisputable his identity in death?
Help us read what the visual itself is saying.
There's actually hardly any photographs that you can use to paint Osama bin Laden because he was in hiding for so many years. And even when he wasn't completely in hiding, he still wasn't, you know, holding press conferences. So there's one press conference he held from which most photographs of him are drawn. He's basically wearing the same thing, and you get him maybe doing some different hand gestures and from a couple of different angles, but basically that's all there is to work with. This picture, I had used the exact same pose for earlier pictures of him, but this was meant to be him dead. One of my favorite genres of painting is medieval Italian paintings with terrible things happening to people, like the crucifixion where Jesus has blood just spurting in little fountains out of his hands, or you know, John the Baptist with his head getting chopped off is like totally gruesome, but also very beautiful. So I was interested, I mean, in the idea that pictures of people in death are seen differently depending on who you are. So to some people it might be a sort of triumphant bloodlust, but to other people it is a scene of martyrdom. And so I made it in the tradition of martyrdom, a sort of a beautiful picture, even though I had his eye shot out and I gave him kind of a stigmata in his hand, and the blood is stylized, and that's what I called earlier the sort of wormy things. So I made it kind of running down his head and down his eyes and out of his hand. And the background is gold, kind of like a Russian illumination. So I was kind of playing on the iconography of, well, literally icons of saints. Mm. And kind of, I mean, in a way this was a joke. By making him look like an icon or a saint, I was partly riffing on the damage that the U.S. had done to their own cause, to their own image, by making some of these decisions.
Daisy Rockwell, it's an interesting moment to be talking about this. Part of the reason I wanted to see you, it's about the Sergeant Bales story of an American military guy who ran amok and killed almost 20 Afghans in a kind of personal riot of we don't know what. And yet everybody is struck by the degree to which we want to make excuses, or we want to see the good in this man, or wonder what it was in his circumstances, in his private life, that can account for this outburst. We can't avoid seeing the degree to which we, when an American kills a lot of people, we want to familiarize the person. We want to see his family, too. When somebody else on the other side does something, anything like it, we want to fanaticize it. We want to satanize it. We want to build a whole different narrative around what happened. Could you paint Sergeant Bales, and what kind of a challenge would that be? What do you see going on in both the visuals and the kind of construction of a story around the visuals of our guy gone bad?
In some ways, I'm always confused by this kind of story. Abu Ghraib is different because it has this element of sadism to it that's really attention-grabbing. But when you find out that a soldier went and killed a lot of civilians, it's appalling, but it's also, that's what they thought they were doing. I mean, some of them may be sadistic and some of them might be crazy and so on, but when I hear that kind of report about Sergeant Bales, I think, well, but he probably thought that he was being more effective than what the army tells you to do. In other words, he felt like he was a better soldier than the army was letting him to be. That's kind of my initial reaction, just because I think war is war and war is hell. And we have all of these people going on multiple tours over and over again, and it goes on and on and on, and they probably start to think they can't really feel that sensitive about the other that they're confronting in this other country, and a lot of them are probably desensitized completely. Plus, they were people that actually signed up to kill people. I would be interested in painting Sergeant Bales, and I might completely change my views if I had a good picture of him. So far, the only picture I've seen is really not very usable. It seems like he was diagnosed with PTSD at one point, and this is a really serious problem for everybody that's been deployed again and again and again. Mm. But on the other hand, I don't know that PTSD is the sort of illness that makes people go and kill a whole lot of people. It tends to make people very fearful and jumpy. I think it's probably unfair to people with PTSD to get an insanity defense for this guy, although, you know, he may have other mental illness issues as well.
What is it in us, I wonder, Daisy Rockwell, that wants to categorize people, and particularly in extreme boxes? Sometimes I think we have to be very carefully taught to ignore the sort of human signals in these different faces. Does the media do it? Or do we, in fact, long to have a world of good guys and bad guys?
The media tends to feed us that line, which we kind of happily swallow it because it's maybe it's easier psychologically to see things as good and bad guys. And when you don't see it that way, then it's harder to analyze where the problems come from. And if you look at, you know, the thing that's disturbing is what it really does in terms of the media narrative is that it masks the fact that there are a lot of people upset with the United States for quite logical reasons that have nothing to do with their so-called religious extremism in the sense that, you know, their countries are having bombs dropped on them or civilians are getting killed and that kind of thing, or the United States is propping up their dictators or their armies. But when you think instead in terms of good people and bad people and they hate us and that kind of thing, or they want to take away our freedoms, then you ignore these other issues and you become blind to the source of some of the problems. And, you know, you see this, like, in the comments, you know, I'd have read a few of them, but the comments on the article about my work in CNN, people are outraged at the idea of any kind of sensitivity to the so-called enemy, because, you know, that shows weakness in the United States, and that means you're a traitor, and so on. And similarly, if you critique the government and what the government is doing, you're also a traitor, even if these same people, you know, hate our president. It's still treacherous to critique U.S. foreign policy. It's very sort of strange little, acrobatics that people have to do to keep themselves in line with this whole way of thinking.
The outrage in the response to the piece on CNN about you is another reason I wanted to meet you. I mean, what is this about that people are so furious for calling attention to the obvious, in a way, the manipulation of imagery? Even here in Northern New England, the headline on the Vermont newspaper story about you is called Sympathy for the Devil. Did you expect that? Maybe it's an inescapable risk in what you're doing, but how do you feel about it?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that many of these stories are used, are contrasted to my grandfather, then it becomes a whole different game.
I'm dying to hear about your grandfather and to make the connection between Daisy Rockwell and Norman Rockwell. Talk about iconographers. Talk about an artist who more and more cherished, I think it's fair to say, of American life, quaint in a way, corny often, but his four freedoms, his Thanksgiving tables, his cafes, his kids in love, his kids playing baseball were masterpieces of distillation of feeling, sentimental sometimes, but real American experience too. Let's work the connections and the differences and the generations. I'm struck by how much continuity there is in your work, even your father's work with your grandfather's work. But what's the Daisy version?
I mean, I think you're right that there's more continuity than I had even initially would have thought. I'm a painter. I'm painting portraits. I'm interested in the zeitgeist, that kind of thing. There's a lot of continuity, really, more so between my work and his than, say, my father's work. But too, you know, the angry commenters on CNN and so on, the contrast couldn't be more stark, because Norman Rockwell is hugely symbolic in American culture, and his, you know, even his name is an adjective. You can say, oh, they have such a Norman Rockwell family. And in fact, I was in the locker room of the gym shortly after Christmas, and I heard a woman say, every year I invite my family over for the holidays, and I expect Norman Rockwell's family to come, but instead they come. and then she said on second thought as she walked away, but, you know, I expect his family is just as bad. But, but, you know, I hear these things all the time. It's just really pervasive, his name as adjective, meaning everything that's good-hearted, normal, family values-oriented, you know, apple pie, 1950s. And then, you know, some more disturbing subtext, sort of white, not multicultural, this kind of thing. So all of, for conservatives, he's become a real rallying cry. And if you look around, this was actually how my connection to CNN came about, that the same author had written an article called "Was Norman Rockwell a Republican?" Because so many candidates in the Republican primaries have invoked his name repeatedly. So this is he's an image that they want to associate themselves with. So my work, if you see it as sympathy with the devil, is considered kind of a travesty against that image. And, you know, that he belongs to everyone and he is a symbol of America. And then I'm coming along and showing a sympathy to the enemy. Whereas, of course, I think my work is not so much sympathetic as it is neutral towards the rhetoric of the, you know, us and them and the enemy and a real American and so on like that. I'm not being, you know, a disloyal grandchild or something like that by painting terrorists. Instead, I'm just looking at the imagery that we're being given and questioning it. And if you think about it, of course, my grandfather was a commercial artist and he painted Saturday Evening Post covers. And so he was not asked to do controversial work. He was asked to do work that appealed to everybody. He wasn't there to question authority, and if he had, then he wouldn't have been able to support his family. But later in life, during the civil rights movement, for example, he changed as times became more difficult and confusing. His work also got more complicated. You know, he painted the famous painting of Ruby Bridges being taken to integrate the schools with the U.S. Marshals around her, showing the kind of violence of opposition. So he waded into those waters himself. And, you know, who's to say what he would be doing nowadays? His work is a product of a particular time and place, and also a particular type of occupation that no longer exists, which is a commercial fine artist.
But let's assume he would be telling stories.
Right.
All his Saturday Evening Post covers did, and we got them. He would also be simplifying in some sense, but he'd be revealing people in their faces, in their manners. How different is your view of photographic subjects? And he worked from photographs too. Really, how different is it? I think I'd argue that he may be doing something very like what you do, looking hard at photographs and thinking, first reflex, what's the story here?
One thing that what he would be doing that he always has done differently than what I do is that he posed every single picture, but people perceive them as snapshots. I think that people are really, really believe when they see a picture of, you know, some girls flirting with the guy at the soda shop, they believe that he came in and he just snapped that moment because it seems so real and it seems like everyday life. But those were all out of his imagination. So he made up all of these moments, and it was very rare that he would take something that he'd already seen. Everyone in southern Vermont seems to have modeled for him, for example. He had many, many models, and he would take many, many photographs and sometimes integrate them together. So if he was painting now, he would be creating scenes and he would be creating settings to reflect what he felt like America was about today. That's my sense. Whereas I'm using completely found objects. And I have on occasion done some posing of people, and it's really quite satisfying because you can have everything that you want in terms of the composition and the way that, you know, the bodies are posed in the image.
Who is your sympathy for, Daisy Rockwell?
You mean besides the devil? I think my sympathy is for everybody, really. I try to be neutral, but I also am looking for what's human in people. In fact, I think I'm sort of too sympathetic. I'll paint pictures of, for example, I painted a bunch of pictures of George W. Bush. With him, for him, I had no sympathy at all. But I still wanted to find out who he was. I felt like my view of him was unrealistically caricatured. I believed the left-wing view on Bush, that he was just extremely stupid and possibly evil and things like that. So I really wanted to explore who Bush was, and I painted a lot of pictures of him with his Scotty dog Barney. In that context, I found his humanity for me. I think he really loves that dog. And you could just see the connection for him in those images that I found. So I came around to having a lot more sympathy for him through the portrait. So I have sympathy for all the people that I paint. It was a little bit hard with Charles Grainer and Lindy England, the Abu Ghraib couple. I painted them on a vacation. It's called Postcard from Paradise, and they're, you know, in kind of have their arms around each other and their heads leaning together, and they're smiling kind of blissfully. It's very hard, I think, to see them positively. But I wanted to work a little bit on Abu Ghraib, and I didn't want to use their images of torture because those themselves have become so iconographic that, you know, I don't want to see those pictures. Nobody wants to see them, and you can see them across the room by now. You've seen them so many times. You could see something across the room and say, oh, that must be an Abu Ghraib, and my instinct is immediately to turn away, go somewhere else, go look at some other picture. So when you see, for example, that figure in the hood with their arms sticking out, that kind of Abu Ghraib image, you could recognize it from a great distance because we know them so well. And so with my painting of Charles Grainer and Lindy England, it's a little tiny painting and it's very pretty. It has glitter on it and it's kind of blue and pink, and people lean into it and think, oh, who are these people? And they read the label. This is at an art opening. And then they kind of recoil because you don't, with icons, you don't really have to even show the image anymore. It's already in our head. We've recorded the Abu Ghraib images in our head, whether we like them or not. So if you just see a picture of Lindy England doing something else, you immediately see those pictures in your head. So that's kind of the effect that I was going for. But in terms of feeling sympathy, I think, you know, I felt a little bit of sympathy definitely for her. She's a very odd character that inspires a singular combination of sympathy and revulsion. She talks about her PTSD and her social isolation and raising a child as a single mother, and you know, the fact that she can't date or really make friends because she's considered a pariah. But then she also said that she had no regrets for what she'd done because those people deserved it. They wanted to kill us. They're the enemy. So in other words, there's no, she hasn't been able to reconstruct her motivation.
Are we in a war of images? Do you feel like a combatant in a kind of war of imagery, of literally iconography?
There's a war, and I don't know if there are even sides, because they're, as I said before, with the pervasiveness of photography, of, you know, cell phone images and computer images, everybody's participating in the kind of the glut of media images in our lives. It's not just the big news outlets, but they are the ones that are spinning the kind of the dominant narrative. It's very hard to break the dominant narrative, and even, you know, fairly sympathetic people don't seem to notice that they're using the rhetoric of basically of propaganda. So it's kind of takes hold of all of our lives. So, you know, I don't know, since I'm nonviolent, I don't think of myself as a combatant. But on the other hand, I do. Once I saw all those attacks on CNN, and then there was a Glenn Beck website piece too. I think that those people saw me as a combatant, and I suddenly felt like I was being, had bullets, you know, raining down on me, and not in reality, but with words and so on like that. So I was seen as playing a role in a kind of a combat. So in that sense, I guess I could think of myself that way. But, you know, I've just been doing this. I've been doing this for years, like, you know, 5 or 6 years now. And nobody not that many people were paying attention, but suddenly they are. And I think, in a sense, I started out only doing it for myself. So in that sense, I can't really be seen as a combatant, because I was doing it for my own quest for truth, basically, and my own quest also to do art and paint, because I had for a long time, and when I was an academic, I didn't paint at all. So it's also just about myself becoming an artist again.
I suppose pacifists don't fight fire with fire exactly either, but there's something of that in your work. There's a great deal of just plain nudging us all, I think, to think about what we're looking at and wonder where these visual impressions come from and also what they're doing to our heads. And in that sense, I welcome all of it. I love this book, The Little Book of Terror, and I feel a great sympathy with what you're trying to do. Daisy Rockwell, thank you enormously for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris. It was a lot of fun.